That was something, huh? If you indulge me a moment, how this was kind of selected. I served active duty in reserves from 1983 to 2007. My first 8 years was 8-9 years. I was active duty, then I went to the reserves, and I retired in 2007. It wasn't until 2003 when I actually got to see some games. Now, I was in the Air Force. I wasn't infantry. I was a plumber. And so my job was to make sure that the pilots had running water. When we got to Kirkuk, our mission, as far as the plumbing shop, was to get that pool running. So when the Army infantry came back, they had some place to decompress. I don't think I got PTSD. So I saw this during the holidays 2 years ago. They had this presentation on moral injury. For some reason, there was a burden lifted from me. I don't know what it was. But yes, I snap every now and then. I don't think I got PTSD. You know, you witness things, you know, you deal with it. But hopefully this exposure to this moral injury program, how many of you have family members that served? Okay. For me, when I got back, it took a couple of years before I can even see anything on TV about the Iraqi war. I don't think I would have been ready to see something like this within a couple of years. When they made mention that you really don't feel anything till years later, there is truth to that. Be patient. Hopefully you know some resources now that you can share with your family members to help them through it. And this is why we're bringing this program here to Prairie State and the Southland. Flesher and Zames argue that society has an obligation to restore returning veterans to maximum health and quality of life comparable to pre-injury status, a concept which dates to the Old Testament. I would like to introduce you to our panelist and moderator for this afternoon's program. To my right, the panelist in the middle is Ms. Walinda Bennett, Director of Multi-Faith Veteran Initiative, EGAN Office for Urban Education and Community Partnerships at DePaul University. Oh, by the way, this is being podcast. I should have said this from the beginning. and our website, I'm starting to podcast these events that we have. So in some way that if we can help out veterans and family members, we could. So on the veterans website, it says events, podcast. And the first one we put in, which we did recently, was Battle Scars. So that podcast is online now, and ultimately this will be as well. Our next panelist is, also think of great questions, please. Think of questions. There'll be time for questions in the end. Ms. Toyin Hines, licensed professional counselor at Road Home Program, the Center for Veterans and Their Families at Rush. And Ms. Carol Black-Smith, co-founder and CFO of Operation Freedom. I must also say at this time, we've had several programs, and there are times that people walk out because it touched the nerve. We do have support systems here around, okay? Please feel free to leave. Come back to the Student Veterans Center if there's an opportunity, and we'll see if we can point you to the right direction to help you. Okay. Our moderator for this afternoon's program is Professor of Humanities at Prairie State College. He has a PhD in philosophy from the University of Chicago, has regularly teach courses of ethics and world religions here. So he has a personal connection to this afternoon's topic through his younger brother, who is an Iraq War veteran who has experienced serious moral injury and PTSD. Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Hiram LaTurner.
I think at some point, and might as well be now, we should, obviously George is a bit taller than I am, huh? We should please thank George for his work in doing this. I think he provides a great service, so let's just give him a applause for his work. And I will quickly share just a little bit of more detail about my connection to the topic. So my grandfather served in World War II, my dad served in Vietnam, and my little brother served in Iraq, and all of them have stories to tell. But one that seems to touch on this particular issue that I think may be worth telling to give some idea of what moral injury can look like. My little brother was involved in a firefight. They were taking, he was in infantry, he was just a machine gunner, and they were taking a lot of fire from a small building. Maybe they were 100 yards away from the building, and so they were directed to return fire, which they did, and they advanced toward closer to the building, and some helicopters came through and just, you know, lit the building up, and things quieted down. So they ran into the building, and my little brother was one of the first to go in. They're clearing each room as they go through, and they found from that room where they were getting all of their enemy fire, there were a bunch of kids, maybe 14, 15-year-old or younger, with a bunch of drugs. They had been shot up, so they were high. Told essentially, we'll pay your family $50 for everybody you hit. These kids are not serious combatants. They're just there to distract and use up military resources. And so imagine you're the first professional soldier to walk into a room and you see that a bunch of kids have been really manipulated into participating and dying in a war that they don't really even care for. And he did nothing wrong in that instance, and yet feels like he's a part of a system that violates some very basic moral values, right? And, you know, it takes years to come to terms with that, not just because of some sense of personally doing something wrong, right? But in a sense of being a part of a larger kind of hell, right? So I have a great sympathy for programs like this that help both to educate us about what moral injury is, the differences between moral injury and other forms of psychological damage and destruction that happens as a result of war, and to help us all be a little bit more empathetic and helpful through education. So having said that, I would like to give some time to each of the panelists to be able to maybe introduce themselves a little more deeply and also share with us any of their own connections to this topic and why it's important to them.
My name is Carol Blacksmith, as you already know. I am one of the co-founders of Operation Freedom, and our mission for our organization is to serve God's word to those who serve. I'm passionate about God and that he has the answers for everyone, but everyone doesn't see God the same way, and that's okay with God. And I feel passionate about communicating that to people, that God wants a connection with each one of you. War hurts everybody. It takes prisoners. may not be a physical prison that people are in, but we are seeing that men and women are coming back with all kinds of burdens and pain that they're dealing with in their heart and mind and soul, and bodies also. So what Operation Freedom started out doing was giving out Bible verses on little 3x5 cards, like this. We started out making a set for active duty. We sent them out in care packages, went to pre-deployment events. Didn't take long to figure out that there were a support system at home, and so we made a set for family members called While I Wait. Just Bible verses to help you wait while your loved one is serving. And then as our troops started coming home, we got invited to post-deployment events and stand-downs and a bunch of other kind of events. And it became obvious that we needed to put together some verses to help those dealing with post-traumatic stress, moral injury. And so we have a set called Returning with Honor. So that's a little bit about us. We've been a nonprofit, IRS recognized for the last 10 years. And in that 10 years, we have given out over 100,000 sets of scripture cards. That's a little bit about me.
Good afternoon. How's everybody this afternoon? Good? Okay, all right. So I'm Walita Bennett, and I am the director of the Multi-Faith Veteran Initiative, which is housed at DePaul University. I am not a veteran, but I do come from a military family. My father was a Marine Corps and had the distinction of also being part of the Montford Point Marines, which were the first African Americans accepted into the Marine Corps. So I kind of, you know, you could classify me as a military brat. The project in terms of the Multi-Faith Veteran Initiative grew out of the death by suicide of my son. My son was a vet. He was in intelligence. He served, he came back, he worked in intelligence, and he clearly had what is now classified as moral injury. Being in the behavioral health field, it occurred to me that there was a role that the community needed to play. And given that we have a 100% volunteer military, we used to have a draft. We don't have that anymore. And I think that because of that, there is what I've classified a military-civilian divide. We really don't understand military culture. And one has to ask the question is, what impact does that have when we as civilians don't connect in a way that is much more personal? So throughout the piece, and I'm sure we'll get into this a little bit later on, how do we as a community help them come back? Because there's a transition. The end of the piece, what you begin to see was the impact that it has on family. We oftentimes classify that as secondary trauma. So it's not just the impact that it's having on the veteran itself, but it's also the impact that it's having on his family and everyone else that they're in connection to. And so I think that it warrants a larger dialogue around what can we do in this healing process, not for the veteran, but for the family as well.
So I am Oloitoin Hines. As mentioned, I am a clinician at the Road Home Program Center for Veterans and Their Family. I work specifically on our family team. In addition to that, I am a chaplain at the rank of major, currently serving with 23 years in the Illinois National Guard. What is most profound about my experience is that as a chaplain and as a clinician, I get to see the before, during, and after of military experience. I get to see the recruits and their families while they're preparing to go off to basic training. Spend time with their families mostly during our summer events or holiday season, and the freshness in their eyes before the drill sergeant ever sets eyes on them. I get to see our cadre and the guard train them to prepare for that specific event, that basic training event in their lives. And then I get to see them when they come back and go into their units and into their specialties, whether it's infantry or any other combat arms, artillery, the mechanics, the aviation, no matter what. And so as a brigade chaplain and family life chaplain, I've gotten to see all of those. But I've also served in capacity as wounded warrior chaplain when I get to see them when they come back from combat and to visit those service members with those visible and invisible wounds. I also have the pleasure of being able to advise the command on morality and also on the morale of troops. And the film, it mentioned something about a commander saying, you can do this, go forward, do what's best for your unit. And the chaplain says, you got it, sir, let me go check on morale of the troops as they go out to kill. And let me check on and ensure that they are able to sustain momentum when they have to go back again. And so for me, that experience as a chaplain in the military, a lot of people want to think you're the proselytizing, Bible thumping, make sure that everybody has the word in a chapel service type, but no, our roles are more extensive than that in the chaplaincy. And then as a therapist, I get to see them many years later, sometimes with new families, as they learn how to work through symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, moral injury, as Walita mentioned, a vicarious or secondary trauma, which is real for military families who live with those who suffer with PTSD and moral injury. And so the full spectrum of that experience informs how I engage my service members, my commanders, and the families that I work with at the Road Home.
Just quickly, how many of you are familiar with the term moral injury? Have you heard this before? Is there a fair number? So a lot who have not. So maybe we'll start with this. Would you guys mind taking up the topic of what is moral injury and maybe distinguish it from post-traumatic stress disorder and maybe give us a little bit of information about both of those?
Sure. Well, we could both do it while we are in this. It's filled together. From my lens in working with post-traumatic stress disorder and moral injury symptoms or reactions, right? Their reactions are similar. However, when you think about the diagnosis of moral injury, which is in the DSM-5, there are four criteria that are met, usually through clinical assessments. It's determined if individual or the severity of post-traumatic stress disorder, and those typically are avoidance, hypervigilance, re-experiencing, and there's a numbing, or just kind of flat out. I'm missing something in that criteria, but typically those are the four. The reactions, however, when it comes to moral injury and PTSD overlap. You'll see these a lot if you go, you can Google it, and there are a lot of Venn diagrams. Yeah, right. And some of those include anger reactions, startle reactions, re-experiencing and recalling reactions, and also numbing, and also the reaction of self-medication that people never want to talk about because social norms say alcohol intake and sometimes medicinal marijuana or prescription medications are norm. So, however, it's those things in excess that is a reaction to, because you don't want to remember the trauma. You don't want to remember the injury. And those substances permit you, or even anger flare-outs allow you, and even numbing enable you to not feel it. And it being whatever emotional response that the memory creates.
I think when you talk about, you know, as Toya said, in terms of moral injury, and the film highlighted it, that it's an internalized mechanism. I define it as a violation of one's moral code. So one of the questions that I often ask is, where did you get your morality from? Mm-hmm. Morality building starts probably from the time you come out of the womb. And it gets reinforced in every major social institution, including the family. And all those other institutions that you come in contact with kind of reinforce those the morality that also gets reinforced with basic social norms, the thou shall not kill. When we talk about the numbing, if I were to ask you, how many of you like pain? Let me see by a show of hands. Nobody, right? And the more intense the pain is, what do you do with it? You use medication, or some people shop, some people eat, which is also linked to emotionality. So there's this impactfulness that impacts your entire self. And there's an emotional numbing that takes place because you just don't want to feel on any level. And if you think about that in the context of humanness, then it actually alters your humanity. That's moral injury.
Excellent. Anything you want to add to that, Carol?
Sure. My definition for PTSD is prisoner to spiritual darkness, because you are living in a darkness, and everything in life is spiritual from the premise of where I'm coming from. And the only way to get rid of darkness is to introduce light. And moral injury is when your heart is injured, when it cannot hold what you have seen, experienced, or had shared with someone else who has seen it. The family members of people who have served in the military have the same intense baggage, only it goes undefined because they weren't there. But their loved one has come home changed, and they're struggling. That's why I believe that God's word helps people. Pick one verse, let God speak to you through that verse. I'm not trying to get people to go to church. I'm trying to get people to make a connection with their Creator.
Thank you. Yeah. Any thoughts? Anybody?
No, I think I just would like to add, in addition to what has already been said about moral injury and the distinction, is that when we talk about moral injury as being internalized, PTSD is external. And so if any of you have ever experienced a trauma, say if you have been accosted, or someone broke into your home, or you know someone that has been accosted, often they suffer from PTSD, which is that external response to some kind of something that you didn't have any control over, but yet your entire body kind of responds to it in a way that ultimately, with enough time, you get over it. Moral injury is something that kind of stays with you. You move through it, and the work that the Toyin does at the Road Home, it's trying to help those who are suffering from moral injury. How do I reconcile so that I can accept the reality of that part of my life and live with it and move on? I don't forget it, but how can I manage it in a way that it now does not become self-destructive?
Did you want to?
No.
You know, okay. So I'd like for you to move, if you would, from that to discussing some of the things. You mentioned that there were things we can do to help them come back, I think. So In your experience, what are some of the things, the top things that people can do to be supportive to help them come back? And then what are some common mistakes you might see that families or friends make in good intentions trying to help people come back, but probably aren't the best things to do?
I think part of it is the expectations that we have. The military culture is very different than the civilian culture in a lot of ways, so that when you think about what happens when you go into the military, there is a transition that takes place. And so before I mentioned about identity, identity is really huge. So you think about who you are. And think about what happens when you go into a culture, as the piece highlighted. Your hair gets cut off. Hair is part of identity. Your language in some way changes. How you speak is your identity. And the point is that we now need to separate what I call this original identity so that it fits into the military identity that you need to develop. So you've gone through this experience and the family has not seen you until after you've kind of gone through that experience and then you come back. What do you expect when the person comes back home? You're really excited for them to come back. What's your expectation? For them to be the same. And you're going to interact with them in that same way. They're not the same. Their identity has changed. And in actuality, your identity has changed because the family has moved on. So now what you have to do is you have to merge these identities, and it becomes very, very difficult and complex because you have an expectation that this person is the same. And in some respects, on the veteran side, they also have an expectation that the family is they're looking for something that is similar. But everything is different. It's a shock to the system. And we unknowingly, unconsciously have an expectation that we're going to, or they're going to, operate in the same way. We push for conversation. And I think that there are some, we could say that there are also some gender issues that get wrapped up in that, particularly when it comes to relational, because women are much more verbal than men. And we just want you to talk to us. And that withdrawal, that isolation, what am I supposed to tell you? That I went into a bunker and killed a bunch of kids? You want to hear that? And if I tell you that, then how are you going to perceive me? So I think that the expectations have to be down and dampened down a little bit, and we have to allow for an opportunity of support to take place. Which means sometimes it's watching and listening. Sometimes it is making sure that when you go out, really paying attention to the body language and the uncomfortability. You know, Toyin referenced hypervigilance. So if you are going out with a veteran and then you're in the store and it's a mall and there's a lot of people around, how long before they decide, you know what, I'm ready to go? Do they get fidgety? Those are all signs, and I think it's really paying attention to those cues that says there's something different here, and finding the appropriate time, and it's going to be different for everybody, finding the appropriate time to say, would you like to talk to somebody? And that's where I think the community comes in terms of creating what we call these spaces. In our program, what we do is we have these sites and we have churches that were housed. And part of what we challenge churches to do is just create spaces where veterans can come and just be.
not ask you a whole lot of questions, not bombarded, but more of a social environment where I can connect. Because in actuality, what we're trying to do is, they're trying to do is reconnect to the community that they left. So that's one, just one small, I think, intervention that can take place. Maybe Toya can talk about some more.
You know, as you were talking, Lolita, and talked about churches and faith communities, I remember when I deployed. I was actually a minister in my church. And no one knew that I was serving. I would put on my Sunday's best and do my thing, and I would leave right after. That was my thing. I didn't linger around in, like, all the social, like, that was just, like, all the chattiness. That's just that. It was just, no. They only knew that I was in the military one day when I got my promotion to captain. And my mother, there's this open space, and my mother yells out, "My daughter was just promoted to captain." Of course, she's a military mom. She's been with me all 23 years. She saw me change. She saw me change when I came home from basic training. And they were just proud of me. They were proud that I was a woman veteran, right? By VA standards, because I deployed, right? I'm a veteran, even though I'm still serving.
Right.
And shortly after, I was informed that I was going to Afghanistan. And I'm like, okay, I'm leaving. I'm going to be a chaplain to a battalion, an aviation battalion in Afghanistan. And I'm repped up, and I'm doing the training, and I'm in church less now. I'm there less. And I'm starting to notice my change. And I finally prepared to deploy, and 2 weeks before going, they said, "No, you're going to Kosovo. It's colder there." So, and that's where I went. And I was there for 9 months, and I came back home. And people would think, oh, it's different there, more religious wars, but lots of suffering because of conflicts and genocide. You still see the aftermath. And when I came back, I was different. And I'm thinking, no, something's wrong with you all. There is absolutely nothing wrong with me. I didn't know anything was wrong. Before that, I was a teacher at a high school. And a high school students, juniors, teaching British literature while serving the guard. And I went into the classroom and I couldn't stay. It was too loud. It was too chaotic. And so the school helped me find a program, and I said, I'm not doing this. I didn't do any of the reintegration after deployment, nor did my mother know about any of those things. And I, after 30 days of being deployed, went back to work. And I couldn't take it. And so I went to my leaders and said, I need something to do. I have to stay busy. I can't take this. And there was nothing wrong with me, you know, because I'm a chaplain and I really got this. I'm a captain. And that's when I went into a wounded warrior ministry. So I 30 days, went through a deployment, and 30 days later, started visiting soldiers across the United States, about 200 of them flying out of the city in two different places, and coming back Friday to get my travel plan ready to see service members again. And I saw every surgery, every injury, every amputation, every mental disorder, every family member, every medicated service member. I got to see all of it. And so I kept doing that for 4 years, on and on and on. That's all I did, that depth of woundedness. And my family still says, you're different. Even when I came back and I worked with DePaul, and I remember we were in meetings for 3 hours, and I'm like, why? This takes 30 minutes. 3 bullet points and a brief, let's move it. And it was hard to be in that space outside of the military and transit. That was hard. I couldn't sit there. And we would do our trainings. Yeah. I would have to get up. And people are like, why is she moving?
I'm like, leave her alone.
Because I couldn't stay. And it was just hard. And remember, there's nothing wrong with me. And so what would I say? Don't rush our return. don't rush it. It was hard for me as much as it was for my mother, and I didn't really realize how it was very hard until one day, I don't know what we were doing, she was doing something, and I yelled, just leave me alone, just leave me alone, stop pushing me. And she just looked at me like, what happened to my daughter? Right. Don't rush the return. Transition is ongoing. Sometimes there's a brief period, and sometimes, I'm still serving, so every military weekend, and they're not weekends, sometimes they're two or three in between, it takes me 3 days to get my mind set into the flow, and it takes me 3 days after. And I'm a clinician, so my work is, they're very helpful, but they know, oh, she has military duty, because I change in those days. So transitioning is always happening for guard and reservists. So I would say, don't rush the return, because my norm is different from society's. One thing Walita said, that women are emotional, not really me. I have emotions and I can express them all, and they look very different. And I can talk, but I want to be very exact, precise, to the point, very key. Because even as an officer, the culture says there's an expectation of how I should be. And I've been acculturated for 23 years. I have 23 years of this. Even though I function in civilian communities, I am not a civilian. I will never be a civilian again. I stopped being a civilian when I entered the military at 19 years old. I'm a veteran. I'm a service member. And my family is not just a civilian family, they're a military family. And they're part of the 1% of the population, and their transition is hard too. And Walita said, your family changes. Well, they do, because sometimes you don't want to be around all those people. And you want to be at home watching Scandal. Saying, that's not real life, but okay. And not all of us have PTSD. We do. There is post-traumatic growth. We did experience and see traumas. We were resilient in our own way around it. And some of us just have moral injury. Transition takes time. It's not always forever, but sometimes it feels like it. And respecting those boundaries for us, I do like to see the doors, because I need to know my surroundings. They call it have a swivel on your neck. I need to know what my risks are. And for women veterans, in addition, because, and some of our male counterparts, because of sexual trauma and its connection to moral injury in the military, because I have to work with those survivors as well. And as a chaplain, they have restricted reporting, which means the predator can be in the same room as the survivor, and I have to sit there with both of them and offer them care. So for some of us, it takes a lot more time. And these are stories that you don't get to tell your family so much, because they are so sacred to those, for me as a chaplain, for those who tell me, those stories are sacred. And I cannot retell their stories without their permission. And sometimes that hinders me from telling my own. I would say, remember there is post-traumatic growth. And also, as a woman veteran, that the experiences sometimes for women veterans can be different from our male counterparts. There was something said in the video, like, they don't shave our heads, but that ponytail is really tight. And no matter how short your hair, you get it there to standard. But the reality of how we are treated in some of our experiences, while we are a band of brothers and sisters, culturally, we are perceived differently because of some social constructs. You saw Miosha Thomas in the video. She is a sister vet and a good friend of mine, and she had to leave her daughter to deploy. Her daughter's in high school now. She's 15 and dating. It's crazy. But her daughter just moved back in with her a year ago. So some of these experiences are very different. And for her, transition is still taking time. So that's what I'd like to.
Yeah, it sounds like giving time and being patient is one of the big things to do. Huh?
It's bigger than patience. I wish I had a word to describe it. It's bigger than patience.
You know, I think it's akin to the grief process.
Yeah.
You know, everybody grieves in a different way. And in some ways, it is the grief because it's a loss of, you know, and I talk a lot about identity. It's a loss of who that person was and a change to something new. And sometimes what ends up happening, particularly in just the normal kind of grief process, you know, over a period of time, people will say, oh, you know, it's been 5 years or whatever. You know, you just need to get over it. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't tell someone just when to get over it. And so it's the same, I think it's the same process, or it's certainly along those lines. And I think that many of us, we're not very patient. And it requires that. It requires that. But it was interesting because you said something when you were, you know, you're going to church and you're getting this promotion and you're getting ready to go out. Rituals are also critically important. Mm-hmm. Now, we have a ritual in our society for almost everything, except when somebody deploys and when they come back. Oh, we see these spots, you know, on the news when they come back, and it's kind of episodic. But it's nothing that's entrenched in the societal DNA. And I think that if, as a community, we instituted rituals, it would certainly help support the family in that absence, because a lot of work could get done in terms of what to expect when they come back. And I know part of the work that we do at the center and Toyin does, both within the context of her work and outside, is also working with families, talking about what the expectations are and making sure that you don't have unrealistic expectations.
One thing I wanted to add, when I am working with communities or service members around moral injury, what becomes significantly important is how they define spirituality and religion. And I think that's a huge conversation to be had. It's not always that the way we believe is different. Even at times, if we still believe, becomes different. And to have those deeply rooted conversations about where our boundaries exist now is very important. I can say that my faith contains me, but I'm very open to the other. But there are times when I question those parts of me, that so then I have to be logical and rational. I have to make officer decisions, like, as an officer, what would you do, not as a minister or a believer. And so I believe that around moral injury and dialogue with community and family members and veterans or service members is having, when we are ready to have that conversation about what that means to me. And even if that means nothingness, meaning atheism or Buddhist faith, then being open to hearing our story around that without judging or trying to help us come to some praxis that it looks like yours. Because it's become different because of our exposure and experience.
Yeah, I wonder if one of the ways you could talk about this. So sometimes you hear, especially with issues of moral injury, where people go, where the moral values change, right? You don't kill at home, suddenly thou shalt not kill doesn't hold anymore, right? You're commanded to shoot people and kill them. So with this shift in identity, how also does the moral change occur, right? So does it ever happen that somebody, in becoming something different as a result of their time in the service, they fear that they have become something morally different, and they're afraid of letting other people see that difference, which creates more tension in this moral injury. So I wonder if you could talk.
No, I think that what I saw in my son, and certainly you can, I think we'd like to hear what mm-hmm. you have to say.
Here. It's interesting listening to you ladies. My name is Herschel Embry. I'm chairman of the Veterans Council at the VA. I'm an ex-Marine combat veteran. And it changes you. And the bottom line is, people have to understand, is it's not something that you're proud of. See, it's hard dealing with the change in yourself, but then coming back home and dealing with that. Plus, you're not proud of yourself for some of the things that you had to do and that you went through, and you're not the same. So like you say, the main thing is patience. And you can't rush it. Because a lot of things I don't like to talk about and dwell on. But it happens, so I can't change that. But thank you for letting me come in, ladies. Really interesting listening to you.
We appreciate you.
We have another one over here.
Yeah, my name is John Ross. I'm a Vietnam vet, straight leg infantryman from Vietnam. Second lieutenant getting shot at by both sides, but anyhow, I went through a hard time over there, came back. My family didn't even recognize me. I was 118 pounds. Life was tough, unexplainable, extremely mission-oriented, couldn't stand the riffraff of civilians who didn't know what the mission was. But when we're talking about moral injury, I would love to talk about moral anger. And in my trials and tribulations of seeking solace, I opened up what we would call the good book and started at page one and read through it, and you get to a point of Exodus and Numbers and that kind of thing, where the Israeli army, some 12,000 strong, went against the Midianites because God told them to do so. And they wiped out 100% of the Midian men. They took all the women who were not virgins, and they were slain. And the 32,000, 34,000 that were left were split among 12,000 Israeli troops. And you take a look at that and say, you know, this is the book of my youth. And this is the model of our morality for all the major Judeo-Christian religions. And you wonder, where are we going from here?
You know, one thing that resonated, I appreciate you sharing that part of your narrative, especially from a Judeo-Christian perspective. When working with, and I'm talking as a clinician now, when working with individuals around moral injury, one thing that Wally to open with is, we all have this moral compass, this psychosocial development, this psycho-spiritual development growing up. We are taught these rights and wrongs. And all of these inform, when, for those of us who serve, when we get into the military and we have to be obey commands, follow command, et cetera, how we're going to respond, how it impacts our own moral judgment. But when I look at other people from other faith lenses who have to make the same decision, as a clinician, what bears to mind is, where did you start in your youth? Where are you now in your adult, typically it's in your adult space? And how is it that you're responding different to your traumatic exposure? That informs how I carry out care. Because I can't answer your question around spirituality from my lens. I have to hear it from your own. I'm saying this because when it comes to in hearing your story, then it bears to mind then how those narratives that you've read in that script, how do they bear witness to your own experiences? How do they inform your morality? How do you make judgment about the decisions you were told to make and had to make during your combat exposure and experiences? And then, now how does that shift as you spoke? How you perceive, how you think, how you feel, what you can't change. Where do you want to go from there? I can't answer them. People can't answer those questions for me. And as a veteran, I get really offended when they try. And I can't answer them for another. And so when I hear you say that, how do I make sense of everything that I learned in the Bible for our Judeo-Christian background, with what I've been told to do and what I did, and reconcile this noise in my head and this internal trembling of my spiritual self to be the best person that I think I can be, or can I be? Am I even good anymore? For my ISKCON or Hindu mentee, the story is different. Because when they talk about wars, it's a different lens, right? For my atheist colleagues, it's even more different. And so when we bear witness to one another's narrative around moral injury, I have to hear that story without judgment or critique. And I believe as a clinician, the most difficult part sometimes is when we constantly have to walk through the narrative until a person is ready. I call it an aha moment. And I won't even call it forgiveness or reconciliation because that means different across sex. It's where then do I begin that authentic, transparent healing of my own self?
Yeah, what I have done is to develop a deep mistrust of what I would call religious administration. And I've also developed a Muslim belief, and I didn't know it was one of their beliefs, that I have two guardian angels. Because of all the stuff I've been through, I should have worn out one a long time ago, so there had to have been two. And I just hope that a higher power somewhere is kicking my butt in the right direction. So I do a lot of volunteering. I work a lot with mentally ill people. I'm one of them. And I've got almost a copyright on being the neighborhood nut of Greater Chicago. But I run about 240 groups a year, plus you do what you can. But it would be very interesting to see developments further along the line of how to heal from moral injury. And please include moral anger. And, I used to tell people the scariest book I ever read is the one you're reading to me on Sundays. So,
To answer your question, there is a program out there, the Rodon program. We actually have variety of treatments for a moral injury. And there are flyers that are sitting out on the table out there that do expound on this.
And there are a variety of different therapeutic, I'll put the clinical lens on for a minute, therapeutic models that are attempting to address it. And so, Toyin talks about the Road Home and their moral injury program, which is more kind of psychologically driven, but you also have art therapy, you have meditative groups, you have art, you have music. There are a variety of different clinical interventions that look at, because it's not a one size fit all. So what works for one may not work for the other, and you obviously as a clinician, you have to be kind of open to a space to say, this is not working. Let's see if we can find something that is more compatible with what you need. And it's always about the person. not the person that's helping, but the person.
In addition, Volunteers of America has a wonderful peer support program specific to moral injury, and they have an event coming up March 19th
yes.
at DePaul University. I will add that Rush's moral injury program is holistic, so we do mindfulness, art therapy. It's an inclusive program, not a singular modality for the treatment of moral, for the treatments of around moral injury.
Great, thank you. We have just a few more minutes left. If there are any questions, let's open some time for that.
Thank you. Hi, my name's Alyssa. My father is a veteran from the Navy. His entire family was also in the Army. And I just had a question for you. I didn't know if you meant to say transition when you were saying that going from civilian life to military life and then back again to civilian life. Because I'm not in the military, I don't know quite how to do that or what that means to you. And I just wanted some clarification just to see what your perception of it is and if it's different from somebody else's. You're more than welcome to explain. But I was just interested because I didn't know what it meant.
So reservists and National Guardsmen. Reserve and National Guard, what it looks like is the summer training, and then they say 1 week in a month. That was the traditional before we had all the upfront of deployments. That's not very true, especially for me at brigade level. I'm usually gone 1 or 2 weekends, or sometimes during the week when a crisis comes out, I go, and maybe 3 or 4 weeks over the summer months. And every time, so for active military, you're on an installation all the time, and you are in that environment. I had the pleasure of being at Fort Benning. It was the most awesome experience. So I didn't have to, when I say transition, my mindset didn't have to shift into, I'm going into a civilian environment. And I'm working with civilians, and I have to behave myself, literally. I can say all types of things, and everyone gets it. And so when I say transition, I mean there's a mindset shift that occurs. Where I work at the Row Home, I'm a colleague on a team with other clinicians. And we have a hierarchy, especially in the medical and academic field. When I go to my service, I am Ma'am, Major Hines, Chaplain Hines. I have subordinates that I supervise, and I'm a leader in that space. So people report to me. I still have to report up, but I have more management. I have over 200 service members and their families that I care for, and I supervise a chaplain with over 500, right? So it's different for me. And so I mentally have to say, and I have an assistant, so mentally I have to change mindsets. I am not a therapist, I'm a chaplain. So in my in the civilian community, I'm the person being referred to. And in the military, I am referring. So all of these modalities, and at Rush, I'm a colleague, I'm not in charge. It's linear. In the military, I get to be in charge. And more than that, responsible for the well-being of service members and their families. So when there is a crisis call, a suicide, a death, a sexual trauma, financial issues. I have to navigate systems to work within the military. So make it Rush, everything is there for me. There are outreach coordinators, financial programs, everything you can imagine at my fingertips. And I just call someone and say, hey, in the military, I can use Rush as a resource, but I have to navigate it differently because they have their chain of command. And sometimes service members come to me confidentially. I'm a mandated reporter if you're going to hurt yourself or someone else. And so I can't always navigate their chain of command system. Let's make this work for this service member. I have to do it discreetly in a way that they can pretend they never come to see me for service. That's what I mean by transition.
And I think also to just kind of add on that, if you look at the literature that talks about veterans, what you hear is this term reintegration. Mm-hmm. And Toyin will tell you, I can't stand that word. Because I'm not sure they're reintegrating. Well, what are they reintegrating into? Because there has been a shift. And so I think transition is a much more appropriate way to describe kind of what's happening, right? If you think about life is this cycle, when we have multiple transitions, whether you're a vet or a civilian, that you go through throughout the course of your lifespan. You know, but as Toyin kind of adequately laid out, that it's particularly because of the space in which she operates, the multiple spaces she operates, she's constantly doing these shifts, mm-hmm. mental shifts, constantly. And, you know, one of the questions that I ask, what does it take for her to do that? What impact does that have on her? I know we're running out of time, but I just, and then maybe we can, you know, maybe do a follow-up on this. But if you think about moral injury now is not just an issue that's impacting veterans. Moral injury is also impacting our communities. Police, first responders, oftentimes we don't think about them, but if you think about policemen and first responders, oftentimes, they've come from a military background. So I think moral injury has become a broader way to really begin to kind of talk about what happens when we are in situations where we're being morally challenged, and how do we navigate those spaces.
Are there any other questions that you wanted to make sure we had time for?
Hello, ladies. My name is Menorah Brown. I'm a student here, and I'm actually in Mr. LeTurner's philosophy class. I just wanted to know, like, as we all have roles as like a student, a mother, a teacher, why do you guys call it a new identity when these guys come back instead of a role?
Because when you think about role definitionally. They do have roles in terms of their father, their brother, their son. But your role is also linked to your identity, who you are. So you may define your function based on whether or not you're a mother or a sister, but that's not the totality of your identity. So I think that when you think about veterans, or military people, when you go into the military, as Toyin also talked about, there's a shift that takes place. No one has an individual identity in the military. You're one. In civilian society, we live in an individualistic society. It's about me. It's not a collective society. The military is a collective, which is why there's uniforms, there's the shaving of hair, or in the female situation, a dictate of what standard, so that everyone has the same identity. There's a physicality to your identity as well as a mentality to your identity. And I think that that's the difference between identity and role, and, you know,
I want to speak as a woman veteran. I am not like other women. And women veterans and I, actually, we were having this conversation yesterday. As women veterans, our identity is very different, even from our male counterparts in the military. For me, it's not a role. It is my posture. It is who I am.
It is a familiarity. You can get a group of veterans in a room, and we'll pretend like, I mean, we not even pretend, we'll know. We don't have to use words. I can't do that. And so, I mean, I can discern, but it's different. So it's not a role. For me, a role is a part you play. I'm not, and as a veteran, I'm not playing a part. I am a being. And so that being is a part of how I perceive myself, how I function around and with others, and that is my identity. And that's the distinction. So when I say there are these transitions and identity shifts, I mean, other than Rush being a military, I also have my own business. I also am a minister. I mean, I have all these other, I'm an advocate for women veterans and community, right? Those are the things that I do. My identity and who and my experiences inform those positions. My role is therapist. That's my label, therapist, because that's what I do, advocate. But in my essence, my identity is woman veteran. And I say that proudly so people are aware, understand that there's a level of expertise and qualification that I bring into a space that can ignite it in ways that can transform it if people become more aware of what it means to be a veteran in any posture, any position. And that's why I use those terms differently.
We have time now for some quick closing remarks, so I'll give you each a chance to be able to say something in closing.
Well, thanks for hanging in here for the afternoon with us. My closing remark would be, if you are seeking healing from anything, fill your life with hope and love. And God is a good place to start looking for that.
I appreciate having the dialogue, because I think that what helps us to understand the transitions and the experiences, or at least help to support veterans when they are coming back, is our willingness to be open to listen and to have a dialogue that increases our knowledge on what's happening in terms of military experience.
Thank you to the veterans in this community, to Prairie State, for having us out today. I encourage you, if you want to learn more about our program at Roadhome Moral Injury, there are flyers that are sitting out, and there are contact numbers available. If you know someone who is impacted by a moral injury, feel free to refer them to us. We will be more than happy to support. Just keep it in mind, our services are available to anyone who served, even if they've been in one day and in spite of discharge type. And it's also open to their families, and we use the word family broadly, meaning your roommate, children, any living person that is any person that has been impacted by your military or a person's military experience. Services are accessible to them, and if we cannot provide, we are partnered with other agencies where we can refer.
I'd like to thank the panel, Professor Turner, for this presentation. Thank you again. We do have the resources at the Student Veteran Center, which is located next to the information desk. We have the resources for Operation Freedom. We have the resources for the Road Home. One of the panelists, I don't know if you'll notice on the program, was going to be Carlton Evans. He wasn't able to attend. If you can see, he's the director of outreach. From my understanding, one time he told me, I don't know if you're familiar that the Volunteers of America has some homeless shelters, places of residency. They call them Manor Care, Manor, Hope Manor, 1, 2, 3. Right, and I think there's another one that may be opening. And sometimes they, Hope Manor Joliet opened. And so amongst that, there are many things that Volunteers of America Illinois is involved with. I'd also like to share, and he does send his apologies. I would also like to share, which was recently brought up by Major Hines, about the moral injury convening. A deeper discussion, conversation. It's going to be on March the 19th, 2018, from 8:30 to 4.
8:30 to 4 at DePaul University.
Right, by Lincoln Zoo.
Portaloo Commons.
Okay, I'm from originally from Brooklyn, pardon me.
I have your brother there, don't you worry.
Okay. And I try to capture Chicago every now and then. But again, I thank everybody here for attending. And again, we have some other things. I don't know if you all noticed that we have a Veterans Resource Fair. And Road Home has a vendor booth that day. So if anyone that you're working with, or family members who might need some information, we'll have those resources here on March the 7th. At this moment, thank you, everybody. Have a wonderful day.